Good morning, Grid Connections listeners, and for those of you who may be listening for the first time, the Grid Connections podcast is the show where we unravel the complexities of electric transportation, renewable energy, and our electrical power grid that ties all of them together. I'm your host, Chase, and in this exciting second part of our two-episode feature, we continue our deep dive with the esteemed Rustem Kocher. This is a great episode, but also check out part one if you haven't already. Rustem was behind Daimler's electric Cascadia trucking program. Now a retired trucking executive, he returns to shed light on the intricacies of total cost of ownership, or TCO for those in the know, the disruptive entrance of the Tesla Semi, the revolutionary vehicle-to-grid technology that electric trucking unlocks, and much more. Building on the momentum of our last episode, we further explore the transformative changes sweeping through the trucking industry, guided by Rustem's unparalleled expertise and firsthand experiences. This discussion is packed with insights on navigating the challenges and seizing the opportunities of electrification in the transport sector. Before we roll into today's riveting discussion, a quick reminder, if you found our previous episode enlightening, you'll certainly want to share this one. Pass along to someone in your circle who's as passionate about the future of transportation as you are. Your support helps us bring more engaging content your way. Also, don't let the conversation end here. Stay connected with the latest in tech and transport by signing up for our weekly newsletter. It's your direct line to the pulse of innovation and the stories shaping our world, along with behind-the-scenes looks of the Grid Connection podcast and getting an early peek of what's coming next. We're always looking to hear from you as well. Our listeners make the difference to what makes a good and great podcast, so please reach out to us. Do you have a burning question, a topic you're curious about, or a guest you'd love to hear on Grid Connections? Reach out to us. Your input helps us make the podcast even more compelling. For those intrigued by Rustem's journey and eager to delve deeper into his current projects, make sure to check out the show notes. There's a wealth of information and resources waiting for you after the episode. Now let's plug back in with Rustem Kocher for the second part of our conversation. With that, enjoy.
So from an operational standpoint, again, the technology is there. The trucks are capable of doing probably 80% of the routes. And right now, long haul is what we would call a corner case. It's if you have a graph that shows what the vehicle is available, capable of doing, it kind of goes like this and it leaves things in the corner. Well, that corner case keeps getting smaller and smaller as charging speed goes up, battery densities improve, and the overall capability of the trucks improve. And right now, all of the major truck OEMs, Freightliner, PACCAR, Navistar, Volvo, are on generation one or generation two of their trucks. None of them have started from the wheels up to design a truck simply to be electric. They're all using components of drivetrain, of chassis, of frame that are holdover from diesel days. The only one that's actually designed it from the ground up to be electric is Tesla. And so when the major OEMs that have this tremendous depth of knowledge of the industry actually get those, what I'll call Gen 5, vehicles done into the market, they're going to be tremendously capable, and those corner cases are going to continue to shrink.
And so when you say Gen 5, does that mean, and I understand this is a difficult question, is that 5 years away? Is that 10 years away? Is that 3 to 5 years away, you think?
Gen 1 is you built it and it works. So you've cobbled together all these parts. You pulled out the old diesel engine and you stuck in the battery and the motor and hey, it works. That's Gen 1. Gen 2 is, well, how do we make this like a smooth operating experience for the customers and maybe get it to a couple? Gen 3 is series production, which is where, like I said, Freightliner, Volvo, those guys are on. Gen 4 is the iteration of that. You make it better. You put more components that are designed for that particular use case into the vehicle. So instead of, you know, some still cobbled together things, maybe you've consolidated four or five components into one, things like that. And then Gen 5 is, okay, we've started with a clean slate, a sheet of paper. We're going to design it from the ground up to be electric. If we wanted it to be electric from day one, what should it, you know, how should it look? How should it operate? How should the frame rails be, you know? Because right now, every frame rail in the world on a diesel truck has what's called a splay. It goes straight, and then it has a little bit, an opening to drop the engine into. You don't need that in a battery electric truck. You even need frame rails in a battery electric truck. And you build a thing on batteries like Tesla's doing. I don't know. So that needs to be investigated. And like I said, those guys have this huge depth of understanding of how to put together commercial vehicles that will stand the test of time and be tremendously capable, and they'll get it done.
Do you think, so it's kind of interesting, like the Tesla Semi program, from what we know, kind of looking on the outside, they had a person who had actually worked at Daimler, kind of originally at the first part, kind of launched the program, and it obviously took a long while for it to get going, and now it's kind of going. It's still ramping up, honestly. But do you think that they have kind of, when you talk about that example specifically, that it takes these other people to kind of get to a Gen 4, Gen 5 to do a clean sheet, do you think that that does give Tesla a pretty significant large advantage in that? Or do you think it's still by the time it takes them to ramp up? Can you share a little bit more of why you think that?
Because they've started with Gen 5.
Yeah.
And I've never worked with sharper, more intelligent people in my life than one of the folks that I worked with at Tesla. These guys, they work really, really hard. They're some of the smartest people, like I said, that I've ever met. And when they encounter problems, to them, it's a challenge. And they just go, oh, boy, let's solve this. And so, you know, you get this thing that in other OEMs, it would be, you know, like, oh, who screwed that up? Oh, you designed that bolt and flange feature. Well, you know, let's hang this on you and then just figure out a way. And what's the, how do we manage the cost of fixing that problem? Tesla's like, oh, we've got a solution for that. Let's go. And then they're on to the next. And it's just, it's a complete different mindset with these guys. So like I said, the major OEMs have this tremendous depth and knowledge of this industry. And I have faith that they'll get a lot of things right. The speed at which they'll get them right, I don't know. It's going to be a challenge.
Yeah, and it is kind of been interesting, given that this conversation we're having right now, and you compare it to, once again, the light duty realm, where Tesla was kind of scaling up. And I don't want to make this all rah, rah, rah about Tesla. Obviously, there's BYD and other kind of companies approaching, essentially, and I know they're startups, but they're kind of approaching it more from that mindset. But when Tesla was scaling up, you had the GMs, the Fords of the world, and like, oh, that's cute and all. If this becomes a real thing, or we actually need to do electric vehicles, we've been making cars for 100 years. We'll figure it out. And to some extent, Ford's been doing it. But like, I just the last conversation we had on the podcast, we had someone talking about the book they had written on GM and the Ultium platform, and that exact experience where it's like, no, this is a very different beast altogether. There's car, there, both electric vehicles and combustion vehicles have wheels. But you start getting to some of the other things, and exactly like you're talking about with the frame rails and these sorts of things, it's also a very different beast. And you kind of have to.
There was a major OEM that designed a battery pack that did not take into consideration the fact that lithium batteries expand and contract. And you know what happens with the Coke can if you put it in the freezer? It eventually explodes, right?
Was is this company in Arizona? Because there was a couple of semis having some issues in the news recently.
I was referring to a truck manufacturer, but it was just an
OEM. Okay.
But, yeah. There's a tremendous amount of learning.
That no, totally. And you're right. That has happened for quite a few different companies.
Yep.
Yeah. So I promised I might ask a few more of these questions. So we kind of talked about around weight, and I think we're kind of in agreement, and I think he's even sees it where it's like, yeah, anything, unless it's long haul, but even then it's getting there. The question more is kind of
corner
when
case
it's going
to
happen.
Continues to shrink. Yep.
Yeah. So we kind of address the weight. Now, what would be really, I think, most interesting is we obviously battery life and range play into this, but on a larger comparison, the difference in maintenance versus a combustion truck, an electric truck, because first 150,000, 200,000 miles. Yeah. There's kind of some pros and cons. Obviously you got oil change and stuff, but then you start getting further in the lifetime and it is wild how much maintenance and how big of things that a diesel engine requires.
Correct.
Can you just share kind of your knowledge base around that?
Parts. Yeah. There's literally hundreds, if not thousands of moving parts on a modern engine. And you go from that to double digits with the battery electric. It's The best view we have on that is the New York City fleet that has undergone a massive transformation to electrification over the last 5 years, and they're seeing huge drops in maintenance costs, and that is due to electrification. So, yes, sometimes a battery pack does have to be replaced. It's quite rare. Yes, sometimes a fuse gets blown. Sometimes you get a short somewhere. But on the whole, we know that battery electric vehicles require tremendously less maintenance than ICEs do. And it's just the number of moving parts. There's a big number with ICE, and it's a small number with battery electric. And you don't get torque.
Well, so it's funny you even mentioned.
If you've ever watched an ICE Class 8 diesel truck accelerate off the line, off a stoplight or something, the entire chassis twists because of the rotational mass in an internal combustion engine. And there's all this torsion and twisting and vibration that goes on in this hugely powerful truck. And none of it happens with battery electric. So all of these OEMs built these trucks to last 1.2 million miles with all these rotational and torsional forces. If you don't have those, how long is that truck chassis going to last? 4 million miles? We don't know.
Well, I think there's two things too. Like even looking at batteries, let's say you have to replace them and stuff. I think the infrastructure and support supply chain for this is already growing and kind of already there, but it's only going to take off even more where like you have to replace a diesel engine. I want to say almost every 500,000 miles, or I mean, and it can be even shorter, but I think that's like the base warranty. It's like, yeah, that too. Yeah. And so while rare, let's say everything does go wrong with the batteries, the fact is you can still recycle them and the infrastructure and the supply chain. And like you look at LFP batteries too, it's just like, it's really becoming simpler and simpler. And it's really becoming more of a thing of just getting the actual manufacturing base built here more versus all of the supply chain, all of the parts that you need for going into a diesel engine, the spark plugs, all these fun little things that really kind of go away pretty quickly. And even when you talk, you just mentioned fuses. And that was kind of funny to me because like you look at Tesla, who does kind of take the clean sheet approach. And you get to like a Gen 5 vehicle, you might, I don't know if they do this in the semi, but I'd be surprised if they don't use e-fuses or other things that actually kind of get rid of that problem altogether, like they do in their regular cars. And if they're not, I'm sure they want to go there.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
To build on that point, so all those things are in place already for the infrastructure and the maintenance for existing ICEs. So the warehouse of parts and the maintenance schedules and all those things exist. That's missing. One crucial piece of that is missing for battery electric trucks, and that's the charging infrastructure. And that's why that charging infrastructure is so important to get built out, so that you can travel east, west, north, south, along the rungs of the ladder to get from LA to Houston, from Houston to New York, from New York to Chicago, from Chicago to Seattle. Exactly. You can do all those runs. That infrastructure has to be in place. In 2019 or 2018, the Tesla supercharger network was just being built out. And there was a group of nerds like me who was watching a father and daughter who was going to do the first cross-country trip using only Tesla superchargers. And they were driving from New York to San Francisco. And there was one stretch across Arizona that had not had the supercharger open yet, and they left New York without that supercharger site open on the anticipation that it would be open in time for them to use it so they could reach San Francisco. And there was about 1,000 of us who were watching online as this was unfolding. I'm like, are they going to make it in time? And Tesla actually opened it specifically for them to hit that site and charge so they could make it to San Francisco. And it was exciting. We're like, yay, they made it. It was the first cross-country drive using the supercharger. And that needs to happen for trucks. You need to be able to do those things. You have to be able to go from point A to point B. And that's why we did the work we did on the West Coast Clean Transit Corridor. That's why it needs to happen up and down the I-95 corridor on the East Coast. And then it needs to happen on 84 and those other cross members, the 10, all those other cross members, the rungs on the ladder. So you have to have the up and downs and you have to have the cross members.
Well, and it's kind of interesting because that goes to what I was kind of mentioning earlier. So I just feel like there's a lot, it's in some ways a lot clearer what needs to be done and where it's going for electric trucks, because so much of it has been done already in light duty. But it kind of goes back to like, it's like 5 to 7 years behind where it was, in the fact that exactly that, like, there just isn't the infrastructure right now to do outside of like having a small fleet in a city or kind of going between cities, which once again, that's still a huge market and that's a great starting point. But to really get all of it done, I think that's what's so kind of great to hear, is it's really not, we need to solve nuclear fusion or something to make this happen. It's just, we need to really more or less build the things. And as we get more of that data and understanding, we'll be able to kind of make everything else better and the technology improves. But in the 5 years or so it'll take to do that anyway, we'll be looking at a much different many different platforms from these different auto manufacturers for their electric semis. So I, it's one of those things that I'm pretty optimistic about, and I think it's a pretty big hurdle, but I actually have the feeling that it's probably going to happen a lot faster, whether it's a Flying J or whether it's a, like you're talking about the company, you've been,
Okay.
So, but exactly that. It's like somebody's going to kind of take the first step. Someone is going to have to be kind of, and I know Tesla is obviously thinking about it and trying to do their own thing to support their semis. And so it's eventually going to happen.
A route from LA to Houston as well, and how they're going to build that out. So,
Oh, gotcha. So, yeah, I mean, it's really, it's interesting that that is the biggest issue right now. But it's also, other than just getting the supply base spun up, it's really nothing. You're dealing with higher amperages, you're dealing with higher voltages, but thanks to MCS, you're kind of building out what that needs to be. You have that spec sheet, and now you just need to go get the manufacturers to actually support it and build it.
And we're seeing one of the other questions come together around MCS. So ABB and Traton, the Volkswagen group,
interesting,
that makes trucks in Europe, formed a partnership specifically to work on MCS and the rollout with commercial trucks in Europe. So it's happening.
That's great.
Yeah.
No, that's great. One of the other questions my friend had, and it's kind of tangential to this, is maintenance. Yep. So he doesn't work for Volvo, but he works for a dealership that sells Volvo semi trucks. And there's obviously, kind of like you have with regular dealerships and the actual manufacturer, kind of sometimes disgruntled, and or not maybe disgruntled is not the right word, but there's
adversarial relationship.
Yeah, exactly. There can be tension. Yes. And one of those is actually around maintenance, and even some of the newer diesels, there's certain things that have to be done by a certain person or that kind of stuff. And he was kind of curious, as we go to electric trucks, what kind of discussions, if you're aware of any, have there been around that, or what kind of the maintenance required and who can do it, or what that requires for maybe even a shop to be, and maybe this is kind of too early to even know what that looks to be certified to really work on these electric semis.
That's 100% a great question. And that's something that the OEMs would never put a truck in the hands of customers without that plan already in place. So there's been a tremendous amount of certification and training and planning for that exact topic, in that if you're going to be a maintenance bay and you're going to work on electric trucks, you have to have the qualified people to be able to even open and touch the truck. You can't have a high voltage system.
Right.
And have someone that's not qualified to work on high voltage systems working. You can't even change the tires on an electric truck unless you've had the high voltage training, so that you know what to touch and what not to touch. And that's very defined from all the OEMs and all the dealerships that work on the vehicles. And that's for the safety of the maintenance personnel and the ability of the dealerships to work on the truck.
And I guess for anyone listening, that does sound kind of intimidating to even change the tires that requires that. But that's also true with diesel engines and the current platforms they have, that there are very specific and much more detailed than you'd think for even what is usually a simple thing for a lot of light duty vehicles. But that's because they also expect there's a chance that Joe Schmo could do his own oil change or something. So it has to be a little bit more proofed in other ways than something like a semi is. But
we have a saying.
I appreciate that. That's really fascinating.
We have a saying in the industry: you make things idiot-proof, and they keep making better idiots.
That is pretty awesome, actually. that I'm afraid that that is true, and I'm curious to see what electrification and that proves to be, because I feel like there's going to be some new ones coming out of that for sure.
I'm hoping not, but I know that for sure it will happen.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the things we've talked a lot about long haul, and we've kind of alluded to EV fleets, but I think it might be just good to just talk about it. So right now, obviously, the easiest thing for, like, let's say, I don't know, Safeway for some reason popped in my head, but any sort of large company that has a lot of semis and has one kind of warehouse or main area that's doing maybe only a couple hundred or even less miles a day, and they all go back to at the end of the night, there's a pretty good and quick use case to make that electrified. What do those discussions look like? And what is sometimes like the hardware or challenges to change a facility that's traditionally been having combustion engine vehicles go to a fully electric one?
Well, no fleet location currently today can do 100% flip. It's simply not in the cards. So any fleet location right now today is going to have a hybrid fleet. It's going to have some electric and some diesel. And to start with, there's probably going to be a small number of electric and a large number of diesel. And then over time, that number will start to grow from the electric side. And then hopefully at some point, it turns into a 100% electrification fleet. But
is that because of, is that because of just in, like, especially if you're looking at like a Southern California, is that due to like actual utility power needs for that location? Or is that just because there just aren't enough electric semis being built at the moment, both, or kind of a mixture of all of the above?
Available of power, availability of vehicles. That's the two issues. And the availability of how much charging you can put in at a specific time. You don't want your facility to be down for too long.
Right.
A day or two, maybe you could cobble by, but more than that, you can't. So you have to eat the elephant in bites, right? So it's any fleet location like that, you have to take
right.
So you have a facility. You need to do the analysis on a couple of things. One is, who's your local utility? Have a conversation with them. Where do I sit on your grid? How much available headroom is there on your grid? In other words, what can you connect me to that you have in surplus nearby? And what are you going to need to build out? Now, what most people don't know is that a public utility is a regulated industry. So they cannot legally have a bunch of extra power at any point in their grid, because they're only allowed to build what customers need and demand. So there's only so much headroom any specific location can have access to, because legally utilities can't just go build a bunch of extra capacity. So you go talk to your utility and they say, yeah, I got 2.5, 3 maybe that I could give you, but you're asking for 10, that's going to take me 5 years. And you say, okay, great. Let's get the 2.5 going. That'll take 6 months to 12 months, maybe 14, to get everything connected to my site and get the chargers in. Let's get that started. And then let's start the process for the 10, and we'll peg that for the 5 years. Then you go and talk to your OEMs and say, okay, I've talked to the utility, because that's the first person you got to talk to. The power's got to come from somewhere. The power should be at the site for 2.5 megawatts worth in 14 months. Let's get the trucks ordered and set for it to deliver then. And then then the next step is, I'm going to go talk to either a consulting company or a company like Black & Veatch or Burns & Mac and design, you know, what needs to go into my facility so that my fleet can be electrified. And that's the design of the site. That's the design of the chargers, the design of the power dispensation, on-site generation if needs to be, battery storage if it needs to be, some combination thereof. And you work that in. The first thing you do when you're doing that as a consultant is you look at the data from where the trucks travel. So if you have a Safeway distribution site, they've got stores that are nearby, and they've also got stores that are a little bit farther away, and they've got stores that are really far away. So you take that data and say, okay, right now with the trucks that can do what they can do, we can get the close ones and the medium ones. We can't do the far ones. That means that's 50% of the fleet. Okay, so we can convert 50% of the fleet right now. We have access to 2.5 megawatts. What number of trucks is that? And you start to say, okay,
interesting,
let's take these off. and off we go. And then so it takes much longer than anybody thinks. It takes about 18 months to 2 years to get fully spun up on a site and get that transfer started. And then you've got to wait for the power, and then you've got to spin up the next one. And what's interesting is that it's much cheaper to prep a site in one go. So we say, we talk to customers and so we touch the ground once so that you're prepared for the next steps of your fleet conversion. So if you can, when you're doing the first conversion, prepare for step two, steps three, maybe even step four, lay the conduit, prepare the switchgear, prepare the pads, all the other things, so that when you want to do your next round of trucks and you get the next round of power from the utility, all you're doing is pulling a few cables, dropping a few chargers, and you're ready to go. It's much, much cheaper than redigging, relaying cable, reinstalling chargers, reinstalling conductors, all those things over and over again.
No, that kind of brings up another question. Something you said earlier when we were talking about Electric Island, and you said, and we have the small 50 kilowatt ones for overnight, which immediately, because my daily is like a Model Y, I was like, shit, that's still a lot. And I was like, well, we're talking about semis here. What is semis. Kind of like the average, what is like the level two equivalent for a semi? So for a EV, like a light duty EV, like anywhere from 6 to 11 kilowatts is plenty for overnight charging. I'm kind of curious. And there's probably a few similar variables, but like, what is good practice for, like, if you have a school bus fleet or something that probably just charges overnight anyway, like, what is there kind of like a set level two band for these kinds of commercial vehicles?
Well, you asked three questions. So let's go back. Yeah. So level two charging is typically AC charging.
Right. That's a good point. Excuse
me. Most of these trucks are going to charge DC. They're not going to carry around inverters on board. So they're going to need DC chargers.
Mm.
Kind of your overnight charge or your long slow charge is going to be 50 to 75 kW, maybe a 40, depending on how long that quiet period is. But what you do want is flexibility. So you may want a charger that could do as low as 40 or 50, but could also be ramped up and supply 450, 800, you know, and have these power modules that can be put into effect. And I call it, as a layman, power sloshing. So if you have a pan of water and you kind of tilt the pan from one side to the other, the water will slosh from one side to the other. So if you have a number of chargers and you have some trucks that need more power than others, you want to be able to move that power around and supply some trucks with more power, some with less, based on what the battery needs and the fleet needs are. And so maybe you've got a truck that needs to go out quick, and so you're going to give him a lot of power, you're going to drop everybody else down. Maybe you've got a long overnight, or maybe a long midday in California where you have a lot of solar overproduction and the power is really cheap. You want to ramp everybody up to, you know, maybe 80%. Speed and just give them a lot of power and soak up a lot of cheap power from the grid. So you want that capability to flex and flow with your charging infrastructure. And what those building blocks are determine how small of a chunk you can go down to. So whether it's 40, 50, 70, everybody's kind of chosen a different chunk of those Legos and how that smallest building block is, so that you can get up fast and you can also get down to a small overnight dispensation. And then you talk about school buses, which is another question entirely. Those things are fantastic for students because they lower emission for a very vulnerable population. And they're also fantastic for the utility because they store power and use power at very opportune times. If you have a fleet of school buses and it's taking the kids to school and come back to their depot and they're plugged in, and they can soak up solar power in the peak of the day when there's a lot of overproduction from solar. And that's happening more and more in Southern California, but in a lot of places in the U.S., you have all these solar systems going in, and you have overproduction between like 10 and 2 midday, and that's when school buses are parked. So they can soak up a lot of power. They can go take the students home from school after school is done. They come back and plug in. They still have a lot of power left in their batteries. and they can be used to send power back into the grid when the utilities really need it, when everybody's gone home, when you see this peak happen in demand. And then later on at night, when nobody's moving anything because the school buses are parked, then they can slowly charge up overnight baseline power again and be ready to roll in the morning. So school buses are a really interesting use case where something called V2G or vehicle to grid or V2X.
I was going to say, that's about the one thing we haven't discussed yet is the whole vehicle to grid process.
Yeah. So school buses are
which
fantastic.
That's actually... Yeah, and I just kind of said school bus as just an example of a commercial thing, but that does seem to be the most common and even the clearest business case, really, for the vehicle to grid working with the utility. And there's a lot of pilots of that going on right now. Yeah. With MCS, I'm assuming that does have vehicle to grid as a pretty strong component of the protocols, right? I thought I'd seen something like that.
We set out the vehicle to grid or vehicle to X was one of the baseline requirements that I had to be able to do. I don't know that we'll see MCS on school bus though, because I think from a power need standpoint, I think what NACS and what CCST can provide to a school bus is more than sufficient. It's the ability to have that communication standard defined so that the vehicle and the grid can talk and send power the right direction when it's required.
Interesting. So with that, when you look at, we talked about school buses, are there, and I think that's kind of the first step for vehicle to grid and a lot of these pilots or applications, are there any other commercial V2G, I guess, opportunities that kind of stand out to you that maybe aren't being discussed enough, or you think are kind of the next big easy wins after the school bus example?
So a commercial truck isn't making money if it's sitting idle. So that's why charging speed can be important for some fleets. Some fleets simply sit idle at times when people aren't working. Whether or not that will change with the rollout of silent, powerful, quiet fleets is another thing entirely. If you can make deliveries at night because you have a quiet fleet, do you run at night? Who knows? Those things will change. If vehicles can go inside of buildings because they don't have any emissions, does that change things? Who knows? We don't know the answers to those things. I think one of the things that hasn't been fully explored with vehicle to grid or vehicle to X is how electric vehicles help communities during times of catastrophe. So we all know that the Pacific Northwest is waiting for
a
big rip, right? It's supposed to be an 8.8 coming, and you have all these public shelters that are set aside. So we're all supposed to be able to go to the local middle school, high school, grade school, whatever, and have shelter. Well, will the power be on? Probably not. If the school district has a bunch of electric school buses, can they take those and provide power to a site with that V2X so that everyone inside has lights and warmth when they need it? Yes. Could you do that as well with city vehicles if they have that V2X capability? Yes. If I'm a fleet that runs Class 8 commercial trucks, is that a viable opportunity for me to contribute back to my community if my trucks can do that? Possibly. Is it a way to make money if the city wants to contract me to do that? Possibly. Some of those things I don't think have been fully explored yet.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, especially when you talk about that example in kind of like cities, not only do they have school buses, there's dump trucks and a lot of these other kind of municipal and city commercial vehicles that we're also seeing electrified. So that is actually a really good and interesting use case for them.
Yep.
With some of the things we're seeing too around the discussion that we've been having today around electrification, one other area I kind of wanted to ask you about was around hybrids or like plug-in hybrids even. Because it was just fascinating what you even just said earlier about, I didn't even think about this, that they won't have AC charging. Then they don't need an inverter and it saves parts. It makes sense because the
cost,
demand they need anyway, it doesn't really.
Yep.
Yeah. And so there's been obviously a lot in the light duty conversations lately about kind of slowing down EV adoption and looking at hybrids and plug-in hybrids, especially as kind of the stopgap. And obviously a lot of pros and I think probably more cons of that actually being realistic or plausible. But there's now been conversations of that in trucking as well, and kind of these kind of interesting, I don't think they'd work in Europe because of some of the requirements they have there, but essentially you've probably seen it where a trailer plugs into a kind of in between the actual tractor semi and then the trailer. And it's kind of like a hybrid slash battery thing. I think given our conversation, I think I know where you probably land on this, but I'm just kind of curious if you've seen any exposure or anything in that realm that's interesting to you or is a kind of valid stopgap to full electrification.
I'll quote Martin Dahm on this, who's the CEO of Daimler Truck Global. And his quote on hybrids was the worst of both worlds. And I agree with him on that. Because if you have a plug-in hybrid truck, or even a plug-in hybrid light vehicle, you're carrying two drivetrains that have been stuffed into the same chassis that would normally fit one. Neither one is optimized. And you carry the weight and maintenance penalty of them being overused when they are being put into use. So you have an undersized battery, an undersized ICE that really aren't optimized to work with each other. And especially with light duty, there's no control over whether or not they get actually plugged in or not. And there was a huge push towards plug-in hybrids being adopted as commercial vehicle, fleet vehicles. It's really common in Europe to, as an employee, to be given a free lease of a corporate vehicle. And so a lot of the companies went with plug-in hybrids 5 to 6 years ago because that was what was available. And most of those got returned with the charge cord still in the original plastic bag, never opened. And so you have a plug-in hybrid vehicle that was built to balance batteries in the ICE that never had the battery charged. And so you had an overworked ICE for the entirety of that vehicle you put on the road. That's not a solution.
I think that's I completely agree with it there, and that's something that we've discussed a lot is that exact example of the. A lot of the perks and incentives that were given for people to have these plug-in hybrids. But then coincidentally, since it's a company vehicle, they also have a gas card. And so it's like, well, if you're just what, and so it's like, as they say, the path to hell is paved with good intentions. It just seems kind of like the epitome of that. And especially in the semi world with what you were talking about earlier with all that rotational force, it's obviously true for light duty hybrid, but much more so and so visible when you see a semi start up and it's just one more thing that's shaking and moving all these different parts. Yeah. Right. And I think that is really interesting. Kind of once again, going back to exactly what you're saying with not needing an inverter. I mean, you're just adding more parts, more subsystems. You're probably going to need not only low voltage and the high voltage, but then you're going to need probably a medium voltage. And it's just been really interesting with electrification. This is a very different thing, but like even Porsche recently has essentially moved to with, I think it was the Panamera. They had like essentially like three different voltage systems in the car. Some of it was due to the technology being new and not having the right suppliers.
Yep.
But then, so they had like a do this and it's a very cool and very, in a lot of ways, impractical, much like much Porsche stuff is, but really cool suspension system that's hydraulic, but also has a electric component. So it was like it had a 12 volt, 48 volt, 400 volt, and then maybe even if you were in the Taycan, an 800 volt system.
Yeah,
which was really impressive, really cool engineering. But it's just so many extra things, and more importantly, so much extra weight. Yeah, exactly. Which I mean, if you have a Porsche dealership, that's you want to be selling that car like crazy, I'm sure. But for most people, it's not practical.
And so who's paying?
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
And bring it in. Yeah. So there was a couple hybrid truck companies out there. Hylion was one. I can't remember the other couple, but they've all gone under. And Daimler was making some hybrid trucks 8 years ago. And there was just no customer demand because they cost more. And then the maintenance was cost more. And so your cost per mile. So we haven't gotten into this, but everything in commercial trucks comes down to TCO, total cost of ownership. So everything can be factored down to what does it cost me to roll this truck per mile? How many cents per mile does it cost? That is flat out the only reason to purchase a vehicle. And so once that TCO becomes competitive, or even in some cases where we've seen it be better with electric vehicles, then it's a spreadsheet decision. You don't buy a Freightliner because you'd buy a red Porsche. You buy a red Porsche because you turn 50 and you're feeling you've got midlife crisis, right? You buy a Freightliner because it has lower TCO than the other guys. And or you buy a battery electric because it has lower TCO than the other guys. And that's what it's going to come down to. It's going to come down to a spreadsheet decision. And we're rapidly approaching from the bottom up. So delivery vans already are TCO positive. If somebody is purchasing gasoline or diesel delivery vans, they're not doing their analysis correctly because it's already TCO positive to go battery. And we're slowly then creeping up to class 4, class 5, class 6, class 7. And many of those cases, depending on your load and your range, are already TCO positive to go battery. And class 8 is next.
Yeah, and actually, it's funny. We probably should have started with TCO since it is so important, especially in the long haul and fleet space. Yep. And we've kind of been dancing around it, but I'm actually glad you brought that up. I feel silly to mention it sooner or call it out more. But yeah, you're totally right. I think that's one of the big things, especially when you're looking at fleets. And you're right. That's honestly like BrightDrop and all these other kind of domestic OEMs have been making a large investment in the commercial space because of the TCO. And it's a lot harder maybe for the light duty vehicles to sell individually to customers. But when you look at the total cost of ownership, whether it's through the oil changes and all sorts of other maintenance that come along with that, the message for electrification, even though there's actually a decent upfront investment to add AC charging, if it's like delivery vans and all these things, but once again, over the total cost of it, and there's obviously incentives for it too, but it pretty quickly pays for itself and it just has so many more moving parts, literally, but also from like even a business standpoint of what you need to be concerned about and the like how large the actual maintenance and kind of upkeep of these vehicles are. What
and very quickly,
have you seen anything? Yeah,
sorry,
no, go for it.
Very quickly, many large municipalities in Europe, and it's starting to happen in the US as well, are banning internal combustion engines in their city cores. And so in many cases, it's a binary decision. Am I going to operate within the city cores? And if so, if I'm going to do that, then I need a zero emission vehicle. So these companies making deliveries, whether they're vans, class 6, class 7, class 8, in London or Munich or Berlin or Milan, you know, if you're going to make deliveries, it has to be zero emission vehicle. So as companies.
Yeah, that is a good point.
Decisions. I want to make deliveries to my customers in this area. I kind of have to have a zero emission.
And I think obviously it plays a role, but obviously that can get a little bit more contentious depending on who you're talking around and the political leanings of stuff, but you're totally right. That is a big part of those decisions. But even then, that I think is kind of maybe forcing or accelerating it, but with everything else we're seeing, it is just cheaper on a purely financial and just logistical standpoint to do it anyway. That just might be like, instead of doing it in 2 years, you're like, okay, I'll just do it this year or something to make those upgrades to meet those needs, which I don't think is a bad thing either. With what you're kind of talking about around the TCO, what are some of the things in your experience, let's say you are talking to someone that's just like, hell no, I'm not, you can rip my diesel engine out of my cold dead hands kind of situation. Let's say they're not being as practical or financially observant, maybe. Are there any sort of things that you have shared with them around kind of the conversation of TCO, maybe not even financially, but just less maintenance or something that, or what are these conversations that you have with people that maybe can be that kind of point that turns them around and kind of opens them up to like, okay, this is actually, let's throw out all the there's all the environmental benefits, but let's forget about that for a second. That actually makes sense. Now I'm interested. What in your experience have kind of been those things?
Well, two things. One, from a financial standpoint, if you're rolling zero emissions, typically you can charge more to the customer per mile because they're willing to pay for it. So you have companies like Target, Pepsi, Budweiser, that are willing to pay more for a cleaner supply chain. So they'll pay you more per mile for that zero emission transportation you provided. And two, one of the biggest headaches in the transportation fleet industry is driver retention. And the zero emission trucks are easy to drive. They are pleasant to drive and they attract non-traditional drivers because they are easy and pleasant to drive. And so fleets who would normally be struggling to find drivers if they have zero emission trucks find that they're attracting a larger number of capable drivers from a larger area of non-traditional drivers. And so they're able to attract and keep drivers, which lowers the costs.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because I didn't even think about that. But in a couple of the clips I've seen about the Tesla Semi and a couple of electric vehicles, they have kind of a, that's when they ask the drivers first, that's been a very common thing that one, it's just a much more pleasant vehicle to drive and just even be in. There's just a lot more kind of newer safety and creature comforts along with in some of the interviews I've just seen anecdotally, they mentioned, I hadn't been a driver before I've gotten into this. So that is really interesting because you're right. I've talking with my friend, that is a pretty common issue is finding drivers and having kind of retaining them, especially.
And then the one thing that we never thought about that came up once we put the trucks into operation was the drivers were able to make it back to the depots quicker, sometimes by 20 or 30 minutes. And we asked them why. And they said, stop and go traffic. When the car ahead of them starts to move in a diesel truck, you have a delay because you've got to get the everything spun up. You've got to get the gears to get things moving. And by that time, you've got a gap that someone from a different lane has pulled into and you've got to stop again. And this continues over and over again. With an electric truck, all you do is step on the accelerator and you never create that gap that other cars are dodging into. And so the trucks were being able to go from LA, from Port of LA or Port of Long Beach and back to the depot, sometimes 20 or 30 minutes quicker because they were able to keep that gap closed.
Interesting.
And stay with traffic. And the drivers loved it because they weren't constantly irritated by people slipping in front of them.
Right. And they could make more lights instead of getting stopped. That's really interesting, but makes a lot of sense. Is there anything else you want to add to the kind of the TCO or kind of that conversation of things that you've noticed can change minds kind of unexpectedly when you're having that conversation around electrification of semis?
Just the simple nature of it. Talking to people about technical change, a lot of them will say that they're interested in going electric because they've started to drive an electric car, or their child has an interest in driving an electric car, who's due to come take over the business, and they've just finished business school, and they're pushing dad to look at what's coming next with technology, things like that. So we've seen a lot of kind of interest from the incoming generations that really want to do maybe not the right thing, as I would term it, as far as the environment's concerned, but the right thing for their business, which is to follow what technology is.
Gotcha. That's interesting. I guess there is actually one other area we've kind of talked about but haven't discussed directly, and I'd be curious to get your thoughts on, and that's a big discussion around electrification is data, and especially when you talk about fleet management and some of the things that can unlock. You kind of talked about of even leveraging that to figure out how you choose the right routes first and kind of make it the most efficient of making that investment. Yep. Is there anything else you can kind of share around that kind of impact that you're seeing around using data more and any kind of more data first approaches that electrification has really unlocked for fleet management and people who operate electric semis?
You don't charge a fleet successfully without using data management and charge management. You have to be smart about it. One of the first fleets to ever go electric was a Foothill Ranch bus service in Los Angeles. And they did not factor in demand charges to the total cost of fueling the buses with electricity. And they got hit with some massive bills because they hadn't thought about that when they had modeled going to electric truck buses for their service. Granted, they were very far on the leading edge of this. So was the utility that provided them. And there was a lot of learnings that everybody came in contact with that rollout. But a smart charge service avoids high demand charges. It avoids high cost per kilowatt charges. It maximizes the capability and capacity of your current charge system, how much power needs to be dispensed to the trucks, the lowest cost per potential per kilowatt hour, potentially the greenest kilowatt hour you can provide to your fleet based on when wind and solar power is available. All those things have to be combined into a very smart system that can dispense power in the most efficient way possible. So yes, data has a huge role to play in deciding, you know, which of those fleet vehicles go electric first, how that power is then dispensed into the vehicles in the most efficient and cost-effective way. And it's really important to work with a partner or become intelligent enough with that sort of data that you can make those decisions yourself. Most of the large fleets I know are depending on a partner because it's a big nut to crack.
For sure. And I know BrightDrop, which is GM's kind of commercial, and even especially Ford through their trying to remember what essentially their commercial program as well. They're saying that's where they're making so much money too, is around essentially the data service that they are selling in addition to these electric transit vehicles and stuff like that. And so it is kind of an interesting full package solution that these and software integration that is, I don't know if it's, I think some of it's indirectly, but a lot of it is just complementary services being sold by going through electrification. And that's unlocking a lot more potential financially. And even kind of in that example, time savings and where to make those investments to have the largest impact first.
It pays for itself. I mean, simply reducing your charging demand when the utility needs more power in other places on the grid can not only save you money, but make you money. And so if you have a system that's able to respond to those demand signals from the utility, your fleet can literally make money by lowering your charging speed. But you have to have a system that knows what the signal is, when it needs to go into effect, whether or not it's going to affect your fleet charging and customer needs, and if, you know, if it can be put into effect and then actually effectuate it. So, you know, all those things have to be done successfully for you to be able to take advantage of that, something like that.
And that does seem to kind of go into the fact, oh, I think my camera just died. But I think it's fine. Let me just try and see if I can switch this word. I realize we've kind of gone over time as it is, so I'm going to try and make this quick. But it's interesting going through with all these different kind of data solutions, how it also could kind of help with a location that's trying to charge and figure out the balancing and working with the utility of leveraging the advantage of going to like using or installing a large battery backup system on that location to help with leveling out and minimizing demand charges, but then also using to sell it back at night as well.
Yep. No, microgrid and battery electric storage, I think, are going to be kind of the two Swiss army knife solutions, especially for commercial fleets, that are going to be really, really useful going forward, avoiding those demand charges. So a demand charge, most people don't know, because it's really only applied to commercial fleets or commercial businesses, is if you have a line, essentially, that if you cross, your electricity charge goes up substantially. So it behooves you to always stay below that demand value as best you can. And so if you have a big demand that suddenly come on because you've got four trucks that rolled up, they all plugged in, they all need a fast charge. You get a big spike in demand, you cross your line that you really don't want to cross with the utility, where else are you going to get power from? It's your on-site battery electric storage that can kick in, bring your overall site demand down to that below that or at that demand line, but still be able to provide the power to the trucks that need to charge. And then once that demand need has tapered off, the battery can slowly recharge from the grid, staying under that line, and then it's available for the next use. Or in your case, you know, when the utility needs it, when they have a big demand going, they can say, hey, can I have some of that power, please? I'll pay you this amount of kilowatt per kilowatt for it. And again, you can make money by feeding it back.
Yeah, and I think that is probably a good place to kind of one final thing. And I realize we've gone way over time, and I think I ask this of a lot of guests, but it is what they would like to see either from government or the private sector to kind of change and help with electrification. My guess is that you would like to see this really mostly through a better charging infrastructure for semis. Yeah. But I'd be curious if there's anything else you would say or add to that.
Right now, if there's a site that's being built for commercial truck power, it needs 10 to 12 megawatts. Nobody has that kind of what they call headroom or that extra power land. And so the lead time on that is 5, sometimes 12 to 15 years, which is just much longer than we have if we're going to try and duck under the emissions requirements we need to cut down from commercial trucks on the road. So there needs to be some letting loose of the reins for the utilities to start moving prior to the consumer indication that they need the power, so that when the customer does come for a particular site, there is enough headroom and there's enough available power so that utilities can provide quicker service to those customers for those charging sites. So it is a big change. I liken it to an increase in gravity. So a power utility from the point that Thomas Edison kind of discovered electricity and they started to move it around New York till today, was they really didn't need to respond to any particular request in under 24 months, because you couldn't build a new building or new demand in under 24 months. If you're building a new apartment building or a new Walmart or whatever it was, you really couldn't build it any faster than 18 to 24 months. And so the utility never needed to move any faster than that. Today, you can pick up the phone and say, hey, I want 20 electric semis delivered to my site, and they could potentially be there in 3 to 4 months.
Right.
Even sooner, when they really start to get up from series production. So utilities just really have to get used to a heavier gravity, as it were. So suddenly they've gone from 24 months to 2.4 months. And so gravity's increased 100-fold. They need the structure to change. They need the speed to change. And they need a little bit of loosening of the reins in the right direction so that they can operate quicker and get ahead of what's coming, because it's coming for every municipality. There's 3,000 utilities in the United States, and they all need to be able to change with this massive switch in technology from internal combustion engines to electrification and transportation.
I could not agree with you more, and my camera's dead, but I think now we definitely have gone over time. This has been super fascinating. I want to say thank you so much for coming on. I know this, I've learned a lot, and I know a lot of the people who are listening have definitely learned a lot about the electric semi space and how much of a big difference that's going to make with electrification and sustainability that everyone is hoping for. So thank you so much for coming on today, and we'll have to have you on again soon.
My pleasure, Chase. Anybody want to come over to Portugal, ring me up, follow me on LinkedIn. Always happy to have a conversation about electrification and transportation.
As we bring this electrifying two-part interview with Rustem Kocher to a close, we want to express our deepest gratitude to Rustem for sharing his unparalleled insights and experiences with us here on Grid Connections. His deep dive into the total cost of ownership, the groundbreaking entrance of the Tesla Semi, and the potential of vehicle-to-grid technology has provided us with a clearer view of the road ahead for the trucking industry and sustainable transportation. If Rustem's journey and the topics we've discussed have sparked your interest or inspired you, don't keep it to yourself. Share this episode with someone who shares your passion for the cutting edge of technology and transportation. By spreading the word, you help us grow and continue to bring enlightening conversations to our community. Remember, the conversation doesn't end here either. Keep up with the latest developments in tech and transport by subscribing to our weekly newsletter. It's your gateway to the stories and insights that matter most in our rapidly evolving world, and you can find it in today's show notes. We also want to hear from you. If there's a subject you're curious about or a visionary you'd love to hear from on Grid Connections, reach out to us. Your suggestions and feedback are the lifeblood of our show, helping us to cater to the interests and curiosities that drive you. For those who are intrigued to learn more about Rustem Kocher and his current projects, we've included detailed information in the show notes for today's episode. Be sure to check them out for a deeper dive in the innovations shaping our future. Thank you for joining us for this special two-part interview on Grid Connections. And until next week, this is the Grid Connections Podcast signing off.